The Questions Log, Week 13. As caped men and women fly through the air, can we truly say the law of gravity is settled law? What are the parameters of thermodynamics when firestorm exists? What other apparently immutable aspects of our understanding of the universe are open to redefinition? Who is there to say that no stone turned can revive the dead? When your social circle includes a literal angel, maybe it's time to start asking questions. This is 52 Pickup.
Hello, and welcome to 52 Pickup, a podcast about the greatest comic book you've never heard of. I am, as always, every single week, Simply Gita. And I'm joined by, as ever, my co-host,
the inimitable and indefatigable professional comic book expert, Alex Jaffe.
And I'm also joined this week by my friend and my former boss and just a cool guy online, Tim Marchman. Hello, Tim. are you speaking now, Tim?
Yeah, I'm speaking.
Great. Well, hello to you. Nice to have you on the pod. We are simply enjoying your presence here. As I know, because I've worked with you for many years, you are not only a wonderful journalist, but also an insane comic book fan. So that's why I really wanted to have you on this podcast for this week. Thank you for coming.
Well, thanks for having me. And yeah, I'm a comic book degenerate. I still get my weekly order at the shop and all the rest of it.
Yeah. That's admirable in your old age.
I've been admiring your Matter Eater Lad icon. Do you have any special affiliation with the Legion of Superheroes? Are you still a card-carrying member of the Legion fan club?
You know, I've never actually really been a Legion guy, but when my son was young, I told him about Matter Eater Lad. We were just talking about ridiculous superheroes, and he thought it was so funny that he is, like, our Xbox plugin. He is just our online presence, and the existence of Matter Eater Lad never fails to bring delight to my heart.
Yeah. A guy who can just eat everything is truly one of the best kinds of guys that exists, in my opinion.
Well, it's also really fun to speculate about the outer limits of his powers, because he's one of those guys who has a kind of goofy superpower. And if you put it down on paper, you're like, he could probably defeat Darkseid trivially if he had a mind to it.
If he just had enough time.
The limit of it is that he can only take one bite at a time, and the Omega beams travel a bit faster than that. But if it's matter, he can eat it. That's the name.
Yeah.
In one of my other professional capacities, I write a monthly column where I answer reader mail about the intricacies and ephemera of comics. And one of my favorite questions I got was, whose stupid idea was Matter Eater Lad anyway? And I got to tell him, oh, that's Jerry Siegel, creator of Superman. He came up with Matter Eater Lad.
Not so stupid anymore.
So watch your damn mouth.
Yeah, this, like, the minutia and the sort of margins of comics is what I find most interesting personally, which is like exactly where Matter Eater Lad falls into, right? That's one of the best ideas for a superhero ever, I think, personally. It's the guy who can fucking eat everything.
Back in the 50s and 60s, they were the X-Men for virgins, I guess.
The X-Men are the X-Men for virgins.
Fair enough. Okay. Well, I mean, there's different kinds of virgins, right? There's there's virgins who are very proud of their virginity, and that's like DC
for vol cells.
Yeah, those are vol cells, and then X-Men are incels, right? That's the two parameters here.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. The the Legion fans were saving themselves for marriage, which is why they were very, very invested in which Legionnaires would get married.
They're all saving themselves for Saturn Girl. That's
I think this is like 100% accurate, and I say this as someone whose first comic was an X-Men comic. That's my fundamental orientation as a fan.
Yeah, no, God. I'd love to have a conversation with you about the recently announced, so now you can tell when this episode was recorded, dear listener, the recently announced revamp of the X-Men line, but this is a DC comic book podcast. Unfortunately, we can't get into that here and now. But I'm not a fan.
Yeah, don't get me started because we'll end up not talking about what we're here to talk about. But
exactly. We'll have. I'll text you about this later.
Yeah. I feel like anytime you're doing something the 500th time.
Yes.
You should think about whether that's a good thing to do. No, it can be. I've certainly like moisturized my skin more than 500 times, and I don't think I need to do it every time. But if you're issuing your 500th press release about how you're bringing something back to its roots. I think there should be a lot of thought process and debate there.
Yeah, I think Marvel and DC Comics both have that specific problem where they're like, we're bringing it back to the roots, just how everyone likes. But they're actually describing a roots that is only like very specific to an incredibly tiny group of people that are now currently in charge of the company. 52 is a victim of some of this, but it's also what makes it good in some ways because it's writers trying to write around really specific parameters that have to force their story into certain directions, but then finding out how to break it anyway.
Yeah, the entire concept of 52 was being told you have your point A and you have your point Z, and then they just abandoned point Z. And that's what makes this unlike any of those other spin cycles we see comics locked in. This is the first time anyone really attempted anything like this, a weekly serialized story set throughout the scope of an entire established comic book universe. And that's why it's something I'm really excited to talk about every episode.
Yeah, same. So I think it's time to start our breakdown. But I wanted to ask, because I was interested while I was reading this issue, are we talking talent this week?
Not a whole lot at the beginning. We have a little bit to talk talent about at the backup, but right now we have Todd Knock and Marlo Alkiza, who are back from the Batwoman Begins issue. Mm-hmm. Other than that, these are all familiar faces.
Great. I was noticing there's some really nice facial expressions, especially in the cult arc. I really love how the faces are drawn in this issue. It's wonderful.
Very expressive on Ralph in particular.
Ralph goes full crazy guy mode. It's great. It really enhances the already good plotting at hand.
Like, it was good when we saw it last week on Captain Marvel going through that, but like, this really takes advantage of just the malleability of
Ralph Dibny's crazy ass face. Yeah. God. Marshman, also, it's week 13 where we open up this comic, and they don't say specifically where the Cult of Connor is situated in the United States, but in the previous issue, Ralph Dibny caught up with Cassandra Sandsmark in Philadelphia. So I'm assuming that this insane cult of resurrection is centrally located in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Whereabouts?
It's not stated. It's a big abandoned church that they seem to be in. I couldn't get a big feel on this building, but it's a big enough empty warehouse that they could fit in a giant statue of a bald man and a huge S-shield-shaped altar. So, yeah. I don't know. Is Philadelphia hospitable to this kind of development?
Yes.
What's interesting is that from the interior, it looks like a church, but from the exterior, it's just like a warehouse with a big skylight on it.
Yeah. I'm assuming that Philadelphia has a surplus of these kinds of buildings.
Yeah.
It in fact does, because the kind of turning over to Philadelphia of the automobile created an unusual number of dead zones adjacent to disused warehouses in parts of town that people actually go to. So like yesterday I was walking to a tea shop from Old City to Northern Liberties, and I went through this kind of dead zone where there are some government buildings. There's the oldest Methodist church in America. It's just like a jumble of things without a lot of street life. And I was actually thinking it would be an ideal location for some sort of super villainous lair, a secret hideout, attempts to resurrect mystic beings using secret tomes, that sort of thing. So I do think it's a really good location. It's also like it's got a good combination of relatively low real estate values and high population density, so you can keep the members of your cult. You know, like you have a lot of potential cult members to draw from, and you have a place for them to be. As opposed to, like, I feel this would be, you know, it'd be difficult in San Francisco, say.
Oh, yeah. I mean, San Francisco, the cult-like atmosphere, it goes towards a totally different demographic of people in different ways, right? In Philadelphia, though, it seems like you get a real street-level ability. Like, they could be recruiting cult members just at your tea shop, essentially. Like, down the street, yeah, just check it out. Yeah, the Cult of Resurrection is right over there.
Yeah, what kind of rhetoric would it take to recruit a Philadelphian into your cult?
I don't think you would want to come right off the top with too much spiritual rhetoric. I think you would want to talk about how you have, like, you have a disused space, you have magic crystals, you have a giant guy sitting over a Superman shield. Whatever is going on the first page of this comic, I think you would tell people, like, hey, you got to see this.
Yeah, and then you could just rope them in from there.
Well, before we get into the interior, I do want to visit this cover a little bit. We see Green Arrow here about to drop the hottest album of 2006.
It's exactly what it looks like. I was thinking that, too. This is the coolest Hal Jordan has ever looked.
I mean, it's basically his Spectre look. If you'll recall, there was a time in the 90s to 2000s where Hal Jordan was dead and he had taken over the mantle of the Spectre because of all of his crimes when he went evil and then sacrificed himself.
Yes, because of all of his crimes.
Yeah, you know, back when he destroyed the entire Green Lantern Corps and became a supervillain, and Geoff Johns later said, oh, it wasn't his fault. There was an alien parasite in his ear. But he's basically using that look here. What's really interesting to me is the fact that Green Lantern is not really a presence at all in these comics. And yet this is the second time in 13 weeks that we've seen him as, like, the cover hero. That's interesting.
Is Green Lantern as big of a cover star that would necessitate this, right? I'm not sure of that.
I would say yes, because in other comics, you need to realize what's going on at this exact time is the start of Geoff Johns' super hit Green Lantern run.
This is
the era where Green Lantern is as big a name as Batman.
Holy shit. Yeah, I mean, you're right that there was a really long period of time, mostly when I was in college, when I was trying to evangelize Green Lantern to all my non-comic book reading friends. And it had everything to do with the Geoff Johns Green Lantern, especially because he introduced a bunch of cool non-Hal Green Lanterns that I could be emotionally invested in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we see in a row here, he's got Zariel with him, who was Grant Morrison's weird angel that they introduced in their JLA run. Metamorpho, personal fave. And way on the right over there is Hal Jordan's best buddy, Green Arrow, who helpfully points himself out by carrying an arrow.
Yeah, I was going to say the thing that really strikes me about the cover of this issue is clearly these guys are trying to infiltrate some hive of ne'er-do-well, and they haven't gone so – like, Green Lantern has his domino gun, which he could easily take off. Could easily take off the distinctive white gloves. Green Arrow is carrying an arrow, in case anyone thinks that, you know, extremely famous industrialist Oliver Queen might be the guy under that hood.
He's there to confirm that. Yeah.
That is the thing I think about a lot, that in Star City or Seattle, depending on when you're reading comics, Oliver Queen is the only person with that beard. And then Green Arrow also has that beard.
He's doing Robin Hood cosplay every day of his life. And he's like, no one will recognize me.
It's almost like if Elon Musk had a distinctive Van Dyke beard running around with a mask on in Austin doing all sorts of things and then disclaiming any relationship between him and this vigilante who was seen preaching man to go to Mars.
Green Arrow is most known for hanging out with Black Canary a lot these days. And Black Canary's whole thing used to be putting on a blonde wig to fight crime. I've always thought that what Green Arrow should be doing is putting on the goatee as, like, a paste on for when he's out being Green Arrow. And then Oliver Queen is clean shaven. That's my reboot pitch.
Supply of spirit gum.
Exactly. You know? Yeah.
I completely agree. Yeah, so now I think we are ready to move on to the first page of this, which is this enormous splash of the Cult of Connor, right? The iconography is all here. They've got this big nude man hanging over and embracing a big altar that is in the shape of the S shield.
I think the nude man is supposed to be Connor.
Really?
And, yeah, I think the bald pate sort of calls back to Connor's evil arc from Jeff Johns' yes. Teen Titans run, where he shaved his head because he discovered he's Lex Luthor's son.
Oh, yeah. That was a time. I forgot when he was like, I'm half Lex Luthor, so I gotta be evil now.
Yeah.
I think a lot of writers forgot about that.
We've talked about how that was Jeff Johns' fan theory, right?
Yeah. Oh, no, actually, we haven't talked about that. That was his fan theory, and then he was like, I'm in charge, I'm going to make a canon.
Exactly. He wrote into the Superboy series as it was running in the 90s, like, hey, I always thought, well, wouldn't it be cool if we found out that Superboy was actually half Superman and half Luthor? And the editor was like, try again. Somebody call Arkham.
In another moment that will make this podcast recording date immediately identifiable, I just saw Dune 2. And, like, it's incredible how much so many of these superhero and mythological stories of a powerful little boy actually just draw on all the crazy stuff Frank Herbert was doing in Dune. Like, being half Harkonnen is like a huge turning point in Paul Atreides' life. And here we go. That also happens to Superboy.
Yeah. I wonder if anything like that will ever happen to Luke Skywalker.
Crazy. the Cult of Connor iconography is really interesting to me because it's like, it's like if you could be a weeaboo for Krypton, essentially. Yeah.
I'll just say the whole thing about their symbol being the Superman logo, but upside down feels lazy to me.
It also feels satanic.
Yeah. That's probably what they were going for. The upside down cross.
Yeah. Yeah. But like the upside down cross, it just kind of looks goofy ass.
Yeah.
Upside down cross is cool when you're 16 and then you grow up and you're like, that's just me wearing a cross differently.
Oh, man. Yeah. So they're all doing some chanting, talking about Rao, the sun that Krypton revolved around before it exploded. There are some references to specific places and cultural elements of Krypton that, as far as I can tell, aren't from anywhere. It's just Mark Waid making it up as he goes. Just because that stuff didn't exist. Why not expand the mythology when you can?
And it's also like these people wouldn't know, right? They're all exactly. Just making it up. Yeah.
The other thing is they don't know about it. If it was real, they like it's that's something I kind of wanted to talk about in this issue. One of Mark Waid's hallmarks is that he is so well versed in the DC universe that when he makes something up, that's a clue that someone isn't on the level. This is something that recurred through his Batman versus Robin series a couple years ago, where Batman is talking to an apparently resurrected Alfred and talks to him about his granddaughter and about some adventure where they got trapped in Riddler's maze. And people wrote it like, wait, that never happened. And he was like, keep reading. And turns out that was Batman testing the fake Alfred, and him going along with it was the clue that this guy wasn't what he seemed. So we're seeing a lot of that here with, like, for instance, the introduction of blood kryptonite, which is not a thing from anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, as this sort of cult ritual is going on, Green Lantern is using Green Lantern powers to psychically communicate with everybody, where Ralph essentially in the next two pages is like, I'm not necessarily I want to explain to you that, one, they're trying to resurrect my wife, which is information we readers know. And then two, that my big concern isn't necessarily that they are doing this, but that I, at this point, can't ascertain whether or not they are onto something.
Right. Yeah. He's brought along certain members of his friends from the Justice League. And it becomes apparent that just as much as he brought them along to bust this up, if it turns out to be something horrible, he's also brought this specific gang of characters because they are in unique positions to talk about the nature of life and death and resurrection.
Yeah, that's when it becomes immediately like why it makes sense that Zariel, a character that no one cares about, is there.
Well, that's an interesting thing, Zariel specifically. Ralph reveals this to the group. We get the title drop, Haystack. Because, we have a Wicker Woman here. Mm-hmm. It was Keith Giffen's very creepy idea to stitch Sue Dibney's face onto this mannequin for this issue.
Yeah, I simply don't like that.
Yeah. It's just very unsettling. Zariel specifically was a last minute change, I found out.
Really?
Originally, Mark Waid wanted Hawk Girl for this scene because Hawk Girl is a character who's constantly caught up in a cycle of resurrection. But as you may remember from a couple months ago, Hawk Girl is a giant woman in the hospital right now. So
that's true.
Yeah.
Oh, man. That is a great idea, but she's simply too large to fit inside this building.
Yeah.
I have a more mundane question about one thing that's going on here, which is, so Green Lantern has put them all in telepathic communication, mm-hmm. but then everyone's complaining about how poorly it works. So my questions are, what is the deal with the earplugs? We seem to be confusing telepathy with some sort of like boneless conduction, yes. some vocalization technology, and it's a little bit wonky on what's going on with that. And then also, because the ring allows for physics violating instantaneous communication across like millions of light years at times. Yeah. What do we think is going on here? Do we think we're being signaled that there's something up with this ring?
Maybe. There's some kind of weird magic afoot, as we'll mm-hmm. see clear evidence of later. And, you know, when magic and sci-fi get together in the same room in the DC universe, that kind of makes the sci-fi stuff get a little wonky, as we see with how Superman is particularly susceptible to it. So that might be a clue.
Yeah, in the same way that I think this is, to me, a lot of the Resurrection Cult of Connor stuff feels very Lost-brained here.
Right.
And Lost is sort of, as a television show, was the master of planting tiny details that would become important later. And that does feel like one of those innocuous details that, as we will see later in the issue, will become of extreme importance. Like, is there or is there not magic occurring here is going to be the question.
So I want to talk more about this specific group. Hal Jordan is here because he came back to life in Geoff Johns and Ethan Van Sciver's Green Lantern Rebirth after famously dying in after Emerald Twilight in the Final Night, doing his stint as the Spectre. Green Arrow came back in Kevin Smith's Quiver run. Uh-huh. And Metamorpho has come back to life three times up to this point, which is why Ralph makes a reference to there basically being a revolving door on the afterlife.
And I remember reading that line as a fan and being yeah. like, they're goddamn right.
Yeah.
Like, I don't ever care about any characters I like dying because I'm pretty sure within 10 years someone will resurrect them.
All right. Just because I was sure someone would quiz me on this, I made sure to go through comic book history and find every time Metamorpho has died. I've got Metamorpho number 17 from 1968. He's executed in a freezing chamber when he's framed for a murder he didn't commit, and he's revived by Urania Blackwell, the Element Girl. Then 20 years later, in Outsiders 27, he's brainwashed by the Manhunters in the Millennium event, and he dies fighting his teammates. He's brought back by the Gene Bomb in the Invasion event. And then the last time he died was 1997 in JLA number 1, the start of Morrison's run, where he's a casualty of the Hyper Clan's attack on the Justice League Watchtower. And he's brought back by his girlfriend, Sapphire, using the Orb of Ra. And that's what brings us to Metamorpho today.
Metamorpho is basically every Star Trek red shirt.
Yeah, like, exactly. Like, you need if you see the cover of an issue, in this issue, a Justice League member dies, it's probably Metamorpho.
Unique design, you probably know who he is and think fondly of him because he's never really done anything wrong, but he's going to die today.
He's going to die today because he's the easiest to come back. He's just gas.
I love comic books so much.
The man's just gas.
Right, as we move through this, Ralph is doing what we call journalism, really, here. Yeah. He is going to the event, he's infiltrated it, and he's brought along experts to check his own biases, because he knows he can't trust himself.
Yeah.
And he's basically asked them, like, what is your read on this? I cannot determine on my own. This is something that I have done in my job many, many times.
So Devem, the guy we mentioned a few weeks ago as the evil greaser Kryptonian from Superboy's past, is passing along this big chunk of what he calls a blood kryptonite, which is supposed to absorb life energy from everyone it passes through. until he uses it to restore the life of this Wicker Sue Dibney.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what's going on here?
I believe so, that they're just passing this. I mean, you know, when Smallville was a popular television show, I once had a friend call me and ask, what are all the different kinds of kryptonite? Because that comes up a lot on Smallville.
Oh, yeah.
And I knew from that conversation at the time when I read this that blood kryptonite was not among these types of kryptonite.
Yeah, but, you know, none of these characters know that. And one thing that is bothering me here a little bit is that right off the bat, like a good journalist, Alf is not starting with a conclusion. He's starting with a question, right? He's like,
right,
hey, this Kryptonian cult might actually be able to resurrect people using some sort of heretofore unknown Kryptonian tech. Like, let's check it out and see if they're on the level. And meanwhile, all of his friends have no curiosity whatsoever. They know that kryptonite has all sorts of strange and unusual properties. And I would think that from their perspective, they should also be curious. Hey, is this something that can be done? Do they happen to have a sample of a kind of kryptonite that can siphon off small amounts of life energy that you won't notice have gone missing and use them to bring somebody back? Instead, they're all, from the minute they see this, they're like, these guys are up to no good. Ralph, it's a trap. And I just think they're getting a little ahead of the fact and their own observations here. Even as I do understand why the hooded cultists chanting a temple with satanic imagery would have them a little suspicious.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things where you just have to confirm the suspicions before you can identify what the facts are, you know? As an editor, I'd probably say to Ralph, you need to reach out to more sources because these ones seem to be biased against anything happening here, probably with good reason, but you should probably talk to more people. Especially because while I like the appeal to emotion where Hal is saying, listen, if we had the ability to resurrect Sue Dibney when she died, we would have done that for you immediately. Right. Like, that is maybe the most human anyone has ever acted about Sue Dibney's death in any of those comic book events that surround it. But it doesn't actually work because we also know a lot of these characters have died and then came back to life way later, way after the fact.
Yeah, you know, it takes some time sometimes. Yeah. That's my favorite scene in Final Crisis Requiem, where they're at Martian Manhunter's funeral. And what Superman says is that we're all going to pray that he comes back to life soon, because it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when.
Yeah, no, that's a really wonderful scene also. And I think that while I like that they bring in the reality of the comic book universe's loose relationship with death, you know, into this, I don't quite buy Hal's reasoning. I mean, maybe it's in character, right? Because Hal is kind of a blowhard. He is kind of a person who says, I've decided this is true, and so it is true. But it doesn't quite answer all of Ralph's questions.
And Hal is fresh off a stint of being the Spectre, one of the most powerful guys in the universe. He was personally responsible for bringing Oliver Queen back to life. And he's like, I would do it for Sue if I was still that guy, but I'm not that guy anymore, which might be why he feels obligated to speak up.
Yeah, yeah. I buy Ollie being like a Reddit atheist about this, right? Like, that's the entire thing that he brings to the table. Zariel, though, I would like to hear more from Zariel.
Well, you know, it kind of explains a lot that the reason we don't hear a lot from Zariel is that he's a last-minute substitution.
Yeah,
For canon's sake. One moment I want to highlight that I really like is when Hal Jordan, a very Mark Wade moment, is when Hal Jordan is like, hey, I was the guy who nominated you to the league, remember? And that is absolutely something that happened in 1973. I had to go back and check.
Mark Wade and you are like the same person.
I got an email from Mark Wade this week, just out of the blue, saying, hey, I was reading a column you wrote last October where you talked about the debut of Superman's heat vision, but it actually happened in an issue of Superboy 2 weeks before the issue you cited. So I had to go back in and correct this old ass article.
So
I was like,
funny.
Hey, thanks to Mark Wade for writing in to correct me on Silver Age Superman.
My God, the only reply guy you're ever going to have to listen to.
Oh, yeah. Mark every Wade. Time. I'm never going to have anything on that reply guy. I have the most annoying reply guy because he's always right.
God damn it. I do like the representation of their friendship here in this like last page before we move on to the other plot in the comic, where everyone is saying, Hal, we think you're a fucking crazy person. However, we are happy to follow your lead on this one.
And Ralph,
sorry, yes. We were talking about how these are just names that no people have anymore. So I mixed them all up. These are someone came up with with these names in the 1950s.
Yes, these were all Leave It to Beaver's classmates.
Exactly, exactly. If they were millennials, then we'd be talking about Khaleesi and fucking, I don't know.
Hunter.
Hunter, God.
With a Y.
I can't wait to figure out what the stereotypical names of Gen Alpha will be.
Oh my God.
Unrelated.
They're going to be like Blurp.
Blurp. Blurpo. My good friend Blurpo.
Gleepo, you come back inside this instant.
Oh man, I can't wait to figure out whether or not Paul is going to become a very popular name in the next few years for people not understanding Dune.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. All the Khaleesi's growing up there. I wish you the best, my friends. But now we're going to move to the other plot of this issue, which takes place in the nebulously defined area of Southwest Asia.
Somewhere. Southwest Asia. Thank you.
So, Marchman, you read this stuff way back in 2006. And
yes.
As a person who's lived a lot more life than I have, coming back to this now a little bit, I've taken so much issue with the politics of everything that happens in the Middle East in this comic book.
You know, so I pulled this up on my DC Unlimited app and I'm running through, and the first thing I see after the A plot is Southwest Asia, and I just groaned internally because I have these long-running objections to this stuff going back to when I was a child. And I remember really vividly reading the Death in the Family miniseries. Mm-hmm. Or I guess it was part of the normal run of Batman.
Yeah,
it was in Detective Comics.
Yeah, so it was in Detective, but I remember really vividly reading in it. There's an issue where the last splash is the Joker steps out of a limousine and he's the new Iranian ambassador to the
United Nations. It's true, guys.
And I remember reading this in the context of, you know, as like a 10-year-old, I understood that a political setup that DC had with like all these fictional countries like Kandak was obviously someone not wanting to piss somebody off and being like really mystified about how all the fake stand-ins for Iran that Batman and the Outsiders and the Justice League had been beating people up in were now not Iran and existed in the same place and time as Iran. And so it was really confusing, and just it made my head hurt. And then obviously other objections to this whole thing.
Oh, I will say before you move on that point is that Kurt Busiek in his JLA Avengers crossover did something really smart where when the Avengers move over to the DC universe, one thing they notice is that the DC Earth is slightly larger than their Earth to accommodate for all these countries that exist there but so don't funny. Exist in their
there
world.
There just like was more Middle East to break up into a bunch of micronations through European
there's
colonialism.
There's more Europe. There's more Africa. There's more Asia.
Well, he really covered something there. But yeah, when I'm reading a DC comic and I see sand and something like Southwest Asia, I'm just like, oh no.
Yeah.
And and here comes Black Adam, and I'm just like thinking about The Rock, and like my mind is
you can't not.
Here.
Yeah, no, this comic book series, like the more you look at it, the more you realize that The Rock's brain was just completely broken in 2006 by this comic book existing. He latched onto it mentally and emotionally and could not let go, like a Doberman Pinscher, just really feral for this. But what becomes very funny in the sequence here that takes place in Southwest Asia is that Black Adam and his ISIS. Companion, ISIS, are saving saving children from a slavery ring. ISIS is freeing the slaves.
This was the second big question I had, aside from general setting. Was so we're looking at it looks like kind of an office park, you know, it's surrounded by barbed wire, maybe it's a biotech facility, it's not entirely clear to me from this context, but they come in and blow it up, they use their powers, and then they have dozens and dozens and dozens of children behind them who are worshiping them, thanking them for freeing them from slavery. But I have these real questions about what they were doing in there.
Yes.
Like, what utility would an army of child slaves have?
Obviously, they're building the train from Snowpiercer. They need their tiny hands.
They just need hundreds of tiny tiny
come on, Marchman, use your brain.
You know, like I've covered trafficking a lot for the last few years, and without downplaying the horrific seriousness of child labor trafficking, I do want to point out that people do it for basically economically rational reasons, right? Mm-hmm. Like not out of malevolence. There's a lot of malevolence in it, but you know, the reason you want a cheap disposable labor force is to do labor. And so I'm just dying to know, what are they doing here? And are Black Adam and ISIS in any way seeking to address the root causes of Southwest Asia's labor?
You know what?
Labor trafficking issue.
It's absolutely actually not. So interesting that you bring that up, because ISIS's whole thing.
Yeah.
But ISIS's whole thing is that she opposes the way that Black Adam was objecting to American economic hegemony by creating an alliance of nations in the Middle East to create their own power center that could stand up against America's military might. But instead of actually fixing any of the problems that she says actually need fixing, they are going like in a bespoke way to just every little tiny crisis center, which will not resolve the problems.
Well, they're not looking to resolve the problem right now. They're looking specifically for one guy. They're looking ISIS's brother.
Right. Before they can do anything good, she has to find her brother.
Yeah. First, I got to get mine.
Yeah.
The one thing I think we're missing from this scene is this, for all that we're clowning on it, and rightfully so, this is the exact moment where Black Adam decides maybe I should be a good guy now. Like, seeing these ill-defined children that they rescued from a miscellaneous child factory is the moment where he's like, hey, maybe I can be Superman.
The Black Adam plotline is one that is made up of plot beats that make sense strung together by writing that I find abominable.
Yeah. It reminds me a lot of like wrestling storylines where they take a character where they need to go for a particular match without really doing the work in between the matches.
This is why I can't get into wrestling. I'm not gonna lie.
This guy is a heel because he needs to be a heel now.
You know, I'm not opposed to wrestling as a concept, but for me, like companion with the incredible moments of catharsis that happened during the matches, I need the interstitial writing to like work, and wrestling does not always get there.
It's not a place where slow burn happens.
It also runs into a problem I consistently have with the characterization of Black Adam, and it's funny that it comes up in this issue, because I have a problem with post-Spectre Hal Jordan in this sense too, which is that he's, however, you know, ageless and immortal he is and has encompassed this much experience, this is the first time it has occurred to him that child slavery is bad and that he might use his powers to thwart it and to find meaning in life. And it's like he's had, what, thousands of years to think about this?
I think it's more like a fact that he's been reminded of that, that he's sort of lost touch with that humanity.
That's fair, but it just goes to the reason it kind of makes me think of Hal Jordan is it's like his experience with being a omnipotent and omniscient figure that transcends space-time doesn't seem to have given him any curiosity about the
potential. And then he just goes back to being Maverick from Top Gun.
It's like, you know, when you've had such unusual experiences as being in a, you know, an immortal being who's seen change in time all over the world, or being a god or a figure more powerful than gods, and it doesn't leave any residue in how you approach experience.
Yeah,
you just gotta wonder about these guys.
I mean, I don't know if you've read J.M. DeMatteis's great Spectre run. It's not on the DC Universe app. Hopefully, it'll be digitized somewhere someday. But like, he takes Hal to some really great places. There's a whole issue about Hal transcending the idea of gender. It just, it's extremely cool. And we really haven't seen anything like that in Hal since he came back.
Yeah, no, it's something I'm goofing on a little bit, but it is, of course, one of the things that I love about comics is that you can have this test pilot become a figure on par with the Endless and then go back to being the test pilot, none the worse for wear.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. You know, I guess what's interesting here is, in terms of Black Adam, And what makes this more believable, probably to the readers of this comic book when it came out, is that there's just not that same level of knowledge in terms of what this character has been through, where, you know, The Rock could get obsessed with Black Adam in this moment of time because there was not anything else in the world that was even anything like this, including the previous runs of Black Adam and what has happened to him as a character.
We were just comparing the Black Adam storyline here to a wrestling storyline. So one could imagine The Rock reading this comic and be like, now here's a guy I can get into.
I'm just looking at this and being very grateful that movie bombed, so we were spared the like a QAnon adjacent sequel where Black Adam frees the children.
Black Adam and the Sound of Freedom.
Yes. Liberating pizza parlors throughout Southwest Asia.
Where, by the way, as they head off with the freed children, where are they going? Because as far as we can see, it's a featureless desert plain.
It's not like they can take all the kids with them back to Khandaq. They presumably flew here, you know?
Well, we saw that Isis controls the winds. She might be able to make them fly.
Her control seems a little imprecise. I also wanted to point this out before we move on. She stops Black Adam from outright murderizing all of these child slavers, which, in my opinion, if you're going to ask me, I think she should have been more cool about that.
Wait, stop, don't.
Yeah, exactly. But then she says, let nature take its course and I am nature. And she uses a hurricane to suck them all up out of there. And it's like, dog, those people are dead.
100%. Isis is like, wait, don't kill them. Let me kill them.
It's very funny.
It is very funny. And maybe unintentionally building into a character moment we'll see for Isis much later in this series. We'll cross that bridge when we get there. But I think now it's time to go back to Philly.
Yeah, now we're back in Philadelphia. The back half of this issue really is about Ralph and Cassandra Sandsmark being deeply traumatized by losing the people they love. It's a big fight scene, but I like the way this fight scene is done because the punching is about their emotions. And they do a very good job of portraying that here.
One thing I do want to keep in mind, this is week 13 of a 52-week series. This is exactly the quarter way point of the series. So this whole fight scene in this church is sort of a punctuation mark on the end of, say, a book 1 of 4. The first time 52 was collected was in 13 issue collections. There was a book 1 through 4 of 52. So this is where the first section of 52 kind of ends. This is where Ralph comes to the a very particular turning point in his journey that started back in number 1 of figuring out what's going on with his wife and this cult and just the spiritual elements that surround their mundane tragedies. So this is the right place to put this.
And it does feel very much influenced by weekly television, right? Mm-hmm. Here, like, it feels like this is the kind of thing you would put up right before a Thanksgiving break,
where
you have to go back to the writer's room, write a whole bunch more, and then shoot more episodes, where you give your readers some time to breathe with that exclamation point on the end of a specific sentence in a character's journey.
Which is really cool. And one of the things that was really appealing to me about this whole series when it came out was that, you know, part of the context for Black Adam and Isis defeating child slavery in Southwest Asia and for this extraordinarily, kind of weird fight scene with the cultists and everything is that it's highly compressed comics. And this is coming after a period where specifically, right, there are lots of comics coming out in which an entire issue is two people fighting with a few quips and witticisms and an entire trade, like basically covers a fight sequence and where specifically all these authority ripping off comics are questioning the nature of superheroes doing good and getting involved in geopolitical conflicts. And one of the things I really love about 52 is that it's completely gleeful in saying that is not particularly mature adult comic book storytelling. And we just want to get back to, you know, fun stuff and cliffhangers and action and lots of stuff getting thrown at you all the time, which you can tell great stories both ways. But the the center had tipped so far away from that that just being completely in your face with those two things specifically was really refreshing and just fun.
Yeah, you know, the Ralph Dibny plotline here, it feels like it calls back to the origins of comic books, which is in pulp fiction, right? Like in serial tales, serial detective novels, conspiracies, doing, you know, boots on the ground, investigating, absolutely, that kind of stuff. And putting that in the same context as the geopolitics, et cetera, of the authority that is the Black Adam storyline, you can see as readers what you prefer. Personally, right, I prefer Ralph Dibny.
Yeah, this isn't just a showcase of the DC universe. It's also a showcase of four very different writing styles in comics at the time. It's typified by the creators doing 52, Morrison-style comics, Wade-style comics, Rucka-style comics, and John-style comics.
Yeah, and And I think especially Morrison, I'm the most familiar with his oeuvre, or with their oeuvre. Morrison has dipped their toe into that geopolitics, superheroes as solver of the world problems style writing. And I believe they do a good job, but also at the end of their runs on those kinds of stories, their ultimate conclusion is superheroes shouldn't do this.
Right. It always leads to authoritarianism. That was literally why the team that did it, that Warren Ellis invented, was called the Authority.
Yeah, we are the authority, behave, is like a very scary thing for them to have said.
Yeah, that's going to be the major arc of the James Gunn universe going forward. So get ready for that.
Man, James Gunn, you can tell how much stuff is personal for him when he is dealing with this shit. Like, you can, it's really, really funny that he's really see, like, his version of the Suicide Squad, it was definitely taking all of the stuff that he did not like about the David Ayer Suicide Squad and being like, I'm going to clown on this for an entire fucking movie. Fuck you.
It's like if you made an entire Watchmen movie about the differences between Zack Snyder's Watchmen and Watchmen the comic.
Yes, yes. You know, like, there's that moment in Peacemaker where he makes John Cena say this, right? He is the director and the screenwriter. So he makes John Cena say, oh, you know, what's his name? Is that comic that got in trouble for jerking off in front of women? That was
Louis
very famous for a long
time. Louis
C.K. Yeah. He like makes John Cena say repeatedly, like at least four times, you know, Louis C.K. got in trouble for jerking off in front of women. Like, you can tell that he personally had took issue with the fact that people forgot about that.
Yeah. Which is funny because, like, James Gunn went through a whole arc where, like, he was canceled for people bringing up a thing he did 10 years ago.
Absolutely. And I think he's maybe the only person in Hollywood who has learned and grown from that.
Yes. Oh, man. What an interesting guy.
I want to write a biography of him. I'm not
going
to lie.
Maybe for a different podcast behind a paywall. We'll talk about it later.
You know, we'll talk about that. We have some plans.
I want to do the play-by-play of this, because when we leave Ralph, he's holding the blood kryptonite, and everyone's left it up to him what to do. They'll respect his decision. And then he says, hey, Rex, remember how we dealt with Kanjar Rose Gamagong that time? Which is an uncharacteristic thing for Mark Waid, because that never happened. But Kanjar Rose was a guy from the Silver Age JLA who was like this bug-eyed dude with a gong that did weird stuff. And here he tosses the stone to Rex, and Rex turns his hands into big clamps and smashes it, and all hell breaks loose.
Yeah.
Cassie tries to use her lasso on Hal. It doesn't work because now Hal doesn't have a yellow weakness anymore, which was still kind of a novel thing in 2006.
I especially like Cassie's reaction here, because it feels very, not only does it feel in character for her, but it feels like these writers understand the character tropes of the teenage girl, the lovelorn teenage girl that they're playing with here. Like, what if the brokenhearted girl from a CW show was also a superhero? She would be doing this. Like, and she would react in this intensely emotional, immature way.
You can see this being the same Jeff Johns who wrote Cassie in Teen Titans.
Yeah.
Being the Jeff Johns who would write Titans, the TV show. Just taking that same kind of, like, seething teen drama and putting it on TV. And just, like, everybody becomes Wonder Girl in that show.
Yeah, I mean, it works when there's only one of them.
Yeah. All hell breaks loose. A fire happens. I was reading some of the comments from 2006 because I troll old message boards to prepare for this. And somebody pointed out at the time that, like, if it's a blink and you'll miss it moment, but it's very clearly Dev himself who sets the fire, if you're paying attention.
Oh,
and he's
yeah.
the one who calls attention to it, telling everybody to leave. Like, clearly he's trying to cover something up. It's just a clue that Mark Waid leaves for you in this scene.
Dear readers, pay attention.
Yeah. And then just the most unsettling moment in maybe the entire series so far, as everybody's fleeing the burning church, the wicker Sue Dibney grabs onto the hem of Ralph's robe and calls out his name.
This whole sequence is beautifully illustrated. It's like a really lovely example of how to make a cliffhanger work, how to radically alter the course of a story. Because at this point, Ralph had completely ceded his emotional side to the to rationality. He's right. Yeah. It is impossible to bring someone back from the dead. And then he is given evidence counter to that fact, and he flips on a dime.
Credit where it's due to Keith Giffen. I think the peeling face off the Wicker Woman here absolutely sells this moment.
Yes.
I would not have landed that way without it.
It's so scary. It's so scary. It is makes such an impact. And it it asks the reader also, like, how would you react if this happened to you? You'd probably freak the fuck out.
And this is where we see those facial expressions start to come in. The whole, this is where Ralph just absolutely loses it as he flees carrying the wicker Sue out with him.
Mm-hmm.
The church burns down. They can't find Ralph. The heroes just kind of scatter looking for him. We find him under a bridge laughing with a burned out wicker husk in his lap, doing the same exact pose that he did back in Identity Crisis, holding Sue Dibney's body. But this time he's kind of laughing maniacally and telling the universe to try again.
Meanwhile, his friends seem to have no real concern over the fact that they've gone into a church, messed around with a religious ceremony that they clearly don't understand, set these people's church on fire, and really put them out when, as far as we can tell from what's going on here, it seems relatively harmless what they're doing.
Yeah, you know, from the reader perspective, we're like, wait a second. Maybe they should have just left Cassie Sandsmark fucking alone. Like, every other time they fuck
with Cassie. It seems like the worst thing they were doing was vandalism. They were defacing gravestones. At some point, they stole a suit from Sue Dibney's storage locker.
They're not committing capital crimes. And now they're persecuting a religious sect. Come on, guys.
I'm sure that was probably like a designer dress or something. Sue Dibney had very expensive tastes, famously. But it can't have been that much. Nobody's dying here. But again, it wasn't them who set the fire.
I like how they set up, like, they before the action takes this major turn, right? When Ralph is like, we were wrong, Hal, we've got to stop fighting. There's enough clues that the reader might just forget about. Where, like when Devim says, forget about Supergirl, she should have known better, right? Look at how easily this cult leader is willing to give up one of the high-ranking members of their cult,
Know? Wonder Girl.
One who is, like, pretty much essential to the project of resurrecting Connor, also. Mm-hmm. You can see that there's something sketchy going on with the leader, but then we're also given, counter evidence that, no, but what they believe in is real. So you can very easily, it's just great misdirection in fiction writing, right? Where you can very easily dismiss those things as just sort of, like, inconsistencies or red herrings, but they will come up as important later.
I will point out, in the interest of pointing out all the clues they're seeding here, there is a shadowy figure in the last scene who's watching Ralph from the distant background, wearing some kind of trench coat, silhouetted entirely in black, that you're meant to miss. But there he is.
Ooh, I missed him. Yeah,
There's somebody watching Ralph here.
You know, it's just moments like that when you realize that these are all writers working at the top of their game. Like, they know what they are doing. Even if they don't know exactly how they're going to get there, they know it.
All at the top of their game?
Well, okay. 99% at the top of their game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you might want to ask Southwest Asia about that.
That's fair. Jesus fucking Christ. Like, it's that plot line. It's like, I want to like it, right? I want to like it so bad. And then it occurs and I'm like, Jesus Christ, why is it happening this way?
All right. I think now we go on to my new favorite part of 52, the origin two pagers written by Mark Waid. This is a very Mark Waid heavy issue. We got that slavery freeing cutaway by Jeff, but the rest is just all Waid.
These backups aren't available in the trade paperback or I believe on the app.
They are available on the app if you check out the individual issues and not the collection.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now on my phone, and it rules.
It's so good. Like, this one in particular is so good.
Let's talk talent for a little bit. All the art for this issue is done by Kevin Nolan, who is a very cool guy for Mark Waid to bring on. Kevin Nolan is kind of, he has a long-running reputation as sort of an artist's artist. He did a lot of art in, like, fan zines in the 80s.
Oh, cool.
And, like, people who are in the know from the comic book fandom back then, like, they treat him like this, like, venerated figure. He got to do some character design on Batman the Animated Series. He worked with Alan Moore on Tomorrow's Stories.
Wow.
So it's kind of like a feather in this series' cap that they got him to do these two pages of Elongated Man. And it's great!
It's a perfect encapsulation of all of the things that people have always liked about Elongated Man, which is that it's something that strikes me is how simple and relatable Ralph's origins and motivations are. He was just a kid who loves attention, which is, I think, most people who end up really obsessed with comic books probably have some similarities with that kind of a character. Oh,
you bet. Yeah. You know, I emceed all of our school events in high school. I was much more comfortable being on stage in front of a crowd than in a crowd.
Yeah, it's if he had not developed elasticity-related superpowers, you can see very easily Ralph Dibny becoming the world's most irritating journalist. You know?
Yeah.
Like, he loves attention, and he got so obsessed with a soda, he found out the chemical formulation of how it was made.
I really like a couple of things it emphasizes.
Yeah.
One is that it emphasizes that he's a mutant, because the obvious question with the Elongated Man is, like, why didn't everyone become the Elongated Man, or why doesn't everyone become the Elongated Man? And this really heavily emphasizes, would not work for everybody. He's a mutant.
The interaction
of his concentrated stretching man extract he gets. And the other thing is that it also foregrounds that he is engaging in heavy duty cultural appropriation here, and probably would come in for some pretty heavy think pieces if he popped up today saying, I went to Southwest Asia and I drank all their soda, and now I'm the world's stretchiest detective. You're really getting the essentials of the character.
Yeah,
this is all accurate to Elongated Man's first appearance when he was a backup Flash character. So it's just Mark Waid, like, look, this is what happened. We haven't had time to update Elongated Man's origin, and you wanted me to tell his origin, so here it is.
Yeah. You know, it's probably the only reason, the other note that I wrote, it's probably the only reason why DC hasn't cashed all in on a Thin Man-style screwball comedy with Ralph and Sue.
Yeah.
Which is something they should do immediately.
Tim, I wanted to say to your point, what this really highlights is to me is the difference between metahumans in DC and mutants in Marvel, is that the mutant gene is something that you just grow into if you have it. But the metagene requires some kind of traumatic trigger that would normally kill a person who doesn't have it.
Yeah.
And that's something that Luthor is really taking advantage of in the Lex Luthor storyline in this whole 52 saga.
It's interesting because, like, the mutant thing in X-Men is a very appealing story convention, because, like, in the similar way to problematically everyone loved Harry Potter back in the day, we were all, quote unquote, waiting for our Hogwarts letter. Mm-hmm. And when you reach puberty, you are kind of waiting for your X gene to activate, right?
Exactly.
You know? But here, like, you can be, it gives more space to how those kinds of stories can be told with the metagene thing, because anybody at any age now can go through an event so traumatic it gives you superpowers.
I love that. Yeah, instead of waiting for your Hogwarts letter, you're waiting to walk through Crime Alley. Hey, Mom, there's a midnight showing of Zorro. Can we go?
God.
Let's take the long way home.
God, I would love a sort of anti-hero story about a guy who was trying to push his parents to bring him into so many traumatic situations that he would activate his metagene.
Yes.
That would be a super fun gag.
Oh my God. Yeah. Some comics have come close. I don't think anyone has literally done that. All of this, every single thing detail we see in these two page backups is from the comics, except for way more Nebraska. This is the first time that Ralph's hometown is given a name. And
oh, cute.
I love it. It's great.
Do you think he's a big Saddle Creek fan?
Yeah, he used to be just vaguely from the Midwest, and Mark stuck him in a specific place.
No, that's good. I do also appreciate that even though it's a bunch of fake cities in DC, when someone's from the middle of nowhere, they're like, let's just find a real town that like is in middle America and situate them there. That's why I really liked in the Impulse comics when Impulse was very specifically living in Alabama.
Right? Yeah, that was great.
That was great.
Or, you know, the Stargirl series is also very specifically set in Nebraska.
Again, I wonder, Stargirl, are you a big fan of Bright Eyes? Let me know.
A Stargirl go on 52 pickup. What's funny to me is that there's been so little character work on Elongated Man since he was introduced as sort of a third stringer his whole life that the backup itself has to tell you about things that are literally happening right now in 52.
It's too bad. It's too bad. Like, yeah. I think that you could do like the 1960s adventures of Elongated Man today, and it would be appealing. Absolutely. It would be very appealing. People would really like a Nick and Nora of superheroes. That's a book that I think would sell super well. The people out there are clamoring for romantic comedies. We used to have
all they
so
want
good.
Is good looking people solving a problem together while bantering.
Exactly.
That's what people want.
Exactly.
I have mentioned last week that my favorite part of these segments is the essential storyline section, which to a baby fan of comics like me at the time told you what to read next to find out more about these guys. This is the first time we're seeing a Showcase Presents. Showcase Presents were these enormous 500-page collections of old comic books that were all printed in black and white that you could read to just read every adventure of this character in the 60s. So Showcase Presents Elongated Man was a collection of every Elongated Man story from The Flash and then from his run on Detective Comics. You could just read that and know everything he did outside of the JLA. Great pickup. If you want that Nick and Nora thing, that's where it lives. And then Identity Crisis, which is where everyone learned who Ralph is, because what else are you going to recommend?
We've already talked at length about my specific issues with Identity Crisis, but holy shit, do I fucking hate Identity Crisis.
Tim, what are your thoughts on Identity Crisis?
I'm not a fan. It's a mess.
It's a big mess.
Yeah, it's a big mess, and it's just like, I think my fundamental issue with it is just that it's like it's really mean-spirited.
Yes.
In a way that's like completely out of nowhere. If you read if you're reading like a Batman comic or a Question comic or something like that, and it's got this like just real cruelty to it, kind of knew what you were in for. It's just not really what you're thinking of with Elongated Man. And it's just like it wants so much moral weight, and it kind of wants to be right in your face and saying like, what do we really know about these heroes and how far they would go and what cruel lengths they would go to blah blah blah, and it just doesn't warrant it. I really dislike it.
It feels like if Disney did like the grisly death of Daisy Duck, like what are we doing here? What is the point?
Absolutely.
Who is this for?
And hey, I think you can absolutely do that. Like there's pretty much no kind of story that is going to offend me or make me say this shouldn't have been done. But I think there are stories that if you do want to do them, you have to execute them very well. And the fact that they didn't do that.
Like the whole mystery boils down to a woman committed murder because she was jealous.
Yes.
I just don't buy it. Like, I'm sorry, not with that group of characters.
All right. Do we want to go to our favorite scenes?
Yes. And my favorite scene, there's a moment where when the big fight is breaking out in the warehouse, where Ollie says, "You'd be surprised how often this happens when they let me into a church."
Yeah. And, you know, ironically enough, the very next year at the Green Arrow Black Canary wedding special, a huge supervillain fight breaks out at the church.
Fucking rules. Yeah. I love, okay, the fact that he's a Reddit atheist just feels so real to me.
Yeah,
like, that's absolutely the kind of guy he is. He's a very Gen X coded, like, left-leaning type, which also means, like, completely non-religious, non-superstition-based at all. He is all about the material realities, and he's like, nah, fuck all this.
He's a guy who was really into Ricky Gervais and now feels bad about it.
Exactly. That's exactly who he is. All right, what was your favorite scene, my good friend, Alex Jaffe?
Mine is every time Mark Waid gets to be a nerd and reference a thing that happened in a comic from 30 years ago. Who is this for? It's for me. I'm the guy it's
You're
for.
You're the guy. Marchman, do you have a favorite scene?
Yes, when they're freeing the trafficked children, the fact that they all have eyes like Tim Drake when he gets turned bad by the Joker in that one animated movie.
Yes! Like,
they're supposed to be looking at Isis and Black Adam adoringly, and instead, it's just a little overdone with how big their eyes are, and so they look like they've been turned into zombified Jokers.
I was thinking there was a panel here where Isis looks a little bit Joker-fied when she's like, "It's all right, you're all going home." She's got like that rictus. It's weird.
If I'm being charitable, that's a setup for stuff that happens later, but perhaps it's just the fact that they are doing a weekly book.
You know? Yeah, exactly. I think that's the case here. You can't be too critical of the art when they're working on this schedule.
Oh, no. And I don't mean it that way at all. It's just taking it as a completed text now. There's a little bit of tension there between what's happening and the expressions. And also there's a lot of good comic goofiness that I really like. I mean, I kind of look at some of the stuff and I look at the cult and I'm like, you know, how do you arrange to have that many robes made? They must be extremely expensive. Seems to really care that these Justice League members have just availed themselves of four of them, or those the spares.
Yeah, well, are they handing them out at the door or something? Are these community robes?
I will say they have proven that they are not averse to stealing clothing, so they might have, like, broken into a fabric store or something.
Yeah, fair enough. Our next segment is the blackboard, which is,
I love the blackboard.
When we throw something up from this issue that we just is a mystery of the DC universe that we'd love to see someday explored. And mine is personally the child slavery rings of Southwest Asia, quote unquote.
Yeah. Where is
that? What are they up to?
It reminds me a lot of Grant Morrison in Batman Incorporated, when Batman is assigning a different Batman to different areas of the world. And he gets to Batwing and he says, "You're in charge of Africa."
All of it? And,
okay.
Wow. That's a pretty huge jurisdiction, Bruce Wayne. Do you have access to a map in the Batcave? Because I'd like to point some stuff out.
David Zavimbe quits that job after 18 issues because
it's too hard, Todd.
It's too big. Batman can't even keep Gotham City under control. That's one place. That's like 10 miles.
Yeah, Jesus Christ. Bruce, what were you thinking? It's just, this is what black people go through, right? You know, we're given the opportunity, but then they actually give us way too much shit and we can't live up to it.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to say whether that's Grant Morrison overlooking something or making a social commentary, but I'm inclined to believe the former, because Morrison doesn't really think these particular things through. That's one of their weaknesses as a writer.
Unfortunately, yes. Yeah. They're Scottish, but they're still in the United Kingdom, which has some very interesting opinions about the entire rest of the world. Sorry, I don't want to get on a tangent with the Batman Incorporated stuff. We got to move on.
Okay. I got a couple things I want to put on the blackboard. First of all, I want to point out that this is not the first time that Zariel was used in this exact way to substitute for a hawk they couldn't use. When Grant Morrison was rebuilding the Justice League, their entire thesis was, we are going to position each member of the Justice League as like a god in a pantheon, because my idea is that our superheroes are our modern gods. And their pitch for Hawkman was that they would be the Christian mythology character. They would literally be an angel in service of God. And DC was like, let's make that a new guy. So Grant Morrison created Zariel because they couldn't do that to Hawkman. So the very reason Zariel exists in the first place is to be a Hawkman substitute. So it's very funny that Mark Waid is using him in that exact same capacity over
here. And you
here.
Know Mark Waid knew this also.
Like, yes.
God, that's so funny.
There's nothing I assume Mark Waid doesn't know, and I'm usually right. The other thing I really want to talk about is the origin of Elongated Man, not in continuity, but behind the scenes, because this is a really interesting thing. We're back in 1956. The Flash comics were best known for the Flash's wacky powers going up against some crazy opponent who could shoot ice or had boomerangs or could control mirrors or sound or torque. And it was like every issue of The Flash was a Silver Age JoJo. And what editor Julius Schwartz was thinking, like, you know, I wish we owned him, but it would be really cool if The Flash could fight Plastic Man. So what Julius Schwartz did was he had the writer and artist create their own fake Plastic Man they could use. And it was only after the issue was published that Julius Schwartz learned, oh, we actually acquired Plastic Man 4 years ago. We could have used him.
Copyright's fascinating.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah, Quality Comics is out of business. Remember when we bought the Blackhawks? We got Plastic Man with those guys too.
So great. God, yeah. I love comic books. I love the entire thesis of this project for me was like looking at how corporations use narrative to solve editorial problems.
Right.
And right. An Elongated Man is the perfect example of that. He was the character created to resolve an editorial problem.
He only exists because two editors didn't talk to each other.
Oh my God. I love it. I love it. I love this. And I love how well it works in comic books versus how badly and how poorly it works in all other forms of media. There's just not enough elasticity, ironically, in those other forms of media to accommodate what happens here, which is decisions being made quickly and people playing fast and loose with backgrounds, right? In the age where we used to get television shows that were 26 episodes long, maybe we could have done it then, right? Because there's just so much material that people will just forget about things that happened in previous episodes. But now we're at a point where every television show is an 8-episode mini movie. And so things have to be way more concrete. You can't just be like, oh, well, we made a mistake. People will get really mad at you.
It's also the fact that it's all a library that's up there on streaming. Yes. It's not something that you just catch when it's on TV.
Yeah. I remember once setting my VCR. God, this will age me. Setting my VCR to record episodes of The Daily Show because I couldn't catch it on time. After, you know, because it was on too late at night, and I wanted to watch it the next day, and they weren't yet running reruns the next day. And it's like, that is what you had to do if you were not going to be around when a television episode aired. So television writers took advantage of that safety net and knew they could just make mistakes or fuck around or have a Hot Springs episode.
I miss
that. We're all going to the planet Ryza today. Why? Yeah. Because we needed a breather.
Yeah. I miss the beach episode. Bring back beach episodes.
I strongly believe that prestige television, I should write about this for aftermath.site, but I strongly believe that prestige television being the default mode of major dramatic television is a huge mistake. Right.
I strongly agree.
Yeah. I think it works with Marshman and I are both watching Shogun. Like Shogun is, that is a television event. That is something where I want every episode to be a mini movie, right? Like I think that's good for that story. But I don't need that for Star Trek. Star Trek, I want fucking 100 episodes of these guys just hanging out and solving workplace problems.
Yeah, I want an episode where they all turn into babies and they have to figure that out.
Yeah, exactly. I want an episode where some guys are trapped in one universe and some other guys are trapped in another universe and they have to resolve that problem. I don't need them to, like, do Omelas, which is what they did.
Yeah.
This is also a bad thing for comic books. Obviously, it is a great thing if you have ultra tight continuity within a certain run of a comic. You can tell great stories that way. But I am really in favor of just not thinking too deeply about why Hub City has a new demonic preacher or a con artist who was taken over the city mm-hmm. every 30 days. Like, that works for me.
Yeah.
I don't need them all. I don't need them all to work together at all. It is perfectly cool if just every month Superman has some new guy came from outer space who he has to beat up.
Yeah, mix it up.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. Well, our next segment is going to be reader mail, which is probably less relevant to you than it is to us anyway. So thank you very much for joining us. If you need a hop off.
Yeah, let's say our goodbyes. Tim, is there anything you want to say to our listeners where they can check you out after they finish listening to this episode?
You know, they can follow me on Twitter at Tim Marchman. That will generally tell you about what I'm up to. And my message would just be stay tuned for the next episode, because I believe my looking, the question, who is the best character in the whole thing, reappears in the next issue. And if I haven't bored you to death too much, have me back on sometime so I can rant about East St. Louis and Dennis Cowan and all the things that are great about DC's greatest character.
Oh my God, no. Yes!
You're going to come back for
How have we not talked about the fact that we are literally both obsessed with Denny O'Neill's question run?
This was like when I initially told Marchman about this podcast, this was the first thing that he brought up.
Yeah. I literally own every question action figure ever made. It's in the background of my camera right now.
Yeah, no, dude, we'll have you back on when things with the question get way more psychedelic. I'm very excited for that stuff.
That sounds very cool. I'll be delighted to do it. And take care, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Take care. No problem. Thank you so much. It's time for answering the questions.
Yes.
Our first question this week comes from Kyle N. If you, like Kyle N., would like to get your question on the show, you could write us at 52mailbag@gmail.com. Kyle asks, I'm loving the show and having a blast book clubbing along with you. How do you feel about the Young Justice cartoon?
Oh, that's interesting. So I started watching it and then I did just, I know it's good, right? Mm-hmm. But the problem that I had was that when you tell me Young Justice, I am expecting hijinks, and it is not a hijinks-oriented show.
No, it is not. It's a very, very different show.
Yes.
What's interesting to me is that the Teen Titans TV show is a lot more like Young Justice, and Young Justice is a lot more like the Teen Titans
comic.
That
is so true. That is so true. Like, I realized when I was watching Young Justice that actually what I wanted to be watching was the Teen Titans show. Like, and the Teen Titans show, when I was watching it, you know, the way I got into comics through Scans Daily, I know, the sound a buzzer, you know, pull a lever and drop me into a pit of piranhas. but part of the reason why I read Young Justice was that I was like, the Teen Titan comics aren't as fun as this TV show. So how do I find the ones where Robin and related superheroes are having a fun time? And people pointed me in the direction of Young Justice.
Yeah. I loved Young Justice, the TV show. I think nobody is better at world building in a superhero universe than Greg Weisman. The work he does is incredible, especially alongside Brandon Vietti. This is the guy who gave us Gargoyles, and he's very much taking that kind of Gargoyles attention to detail and building seeds for plots that will only pay off hundreds of episodes in the future if he ever gets there and applying that to a superhero world. And it's something that makes seasons 1 and 2 before it got canceled the first time extremely interesting to me. And I think I would feel the same way about the later seasons if they had the same budget as the first. But it was very clear that as niche shows on these streaming networks in their infancies, first DC Universe and next HBO Max, they were kind of struggling to tell the same stories they used to with a fraction of the budget. And there ended up being a lot of still frames, a lot of exposition dumps instead of like showing you the actual thing that happened, and just a lot of compromises to get the story that's been building in Greg's head out there for 10 years rather than having it show up on the screen. And I doubt it's going to see a second resurgence because that those third and fourth seasons were just by circumstances outside their control, a lot weaker than the first two.
It's really too bad. Like, it's too bad that this is as a result of business decisions that were made that were completely outside of the control of these creators, that their vision was cut short. And that is so the story of almost everything that's happening with Warner Brothers Discovery right now. And it sucks. And all the people I know that work in animation told me, like, it happened to us first, but that does not mean that it's not going to happen in live action. And now we're seeing it happen in live action.
Yeah. The reason Young Justice was canceled the first time was because the success of a show on Cartoon Network in 2010 was directly defined by the toy sales it led to. And there just wasn't really much of a toy line for Young Justice, and the few they had weren't selling. So despite it having a significant audience, it wasn't the audience they wanted, so they axed it. And it just hasn't found a profitable home since.
That's too bad.
Yeah. So that's how I feel about Young Justice. I love it for the thoughts behind it, but the execution, there's a lot of corporate stuff going on there.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, too bad.
I want to mention Landon Wright, who wrote us a very, very long email asking if anyone knew what Grant Morrison was doing with the New Gods between Seven Soldiers and Final Crisis, and whether anyone else had really acknowledged it or follow up with it since. It felt a lot like one of those more of a comment than a question emails, but mm-hmm. I just want to address it to say, the answer to the question, such as it is no. The whole yeah. thing about Countdown and Final Crisis itself and Death of the New Gods, the whole reason that doesn't work is because nobody could figure out what Grant Morrison was doing with the New Gods, and they had to write about it anyway. So we have like years of evidence that no one had any fucking clue.
I was trying my hardest also to understand yeah. what the fuck oh, we they all were doing. I really wanted to know, and it was impossible yeah. to figure out. I think as a story, it does honestly work better that everything that happens in Final Crisis is as a result of a like religious schism that has happened outside of the knowledge of these characters, that yeah. you know, everything that happens on Earth is just like splash damage from stuff that's happening that they don't have any fucking clue about. I right. think that's better than knowing exactly what happened. By God, I tried.
I think that's very much in the spirit of Kirby's original comics, that it's yes. this huge war we can barely comprehend splashing onto Earth.
Yes, yes. And it does feel like in the spirit of the stuff that I do like about the New Gods is not actually really knowing what's true or not.
I feel like if you told Grant Morrison that you understood what they were doing with the New Gods, they would be disappointed.
Yeah, I think so, too.
It's like, oh, I should have made it harder.
Yeah, they've expressed this idea about comics that I generally like and believe is a good approach to writing and interacting with comics, is to think about it in terms of how you understand these things as a child. As a child, you pick up an issue of a comic book because it looks cool and you don't understand everything that happens.
Yes.
In it. And that is why it rocks, that there's always something slightly outside of your understanding that makes it feel much bigger, more mystical, more epic, more mythological than it probably really is. And Grant Morrison's approach to comic book writing is to not have that be because you're a child, but because they're gesturing towards things that are actually too cool to really represent without making them yeah. less cool.
Absolutely. Just the idea of them. I think this next question is just for you, Geet. It's from Sean. Sean asks, did you see they're making Saltburn Funko Pops? Who are these for?
Why would they do that? So my whole thing is I only buy Funko Pops of the stupidest things I could possibly imagine.
Well, that's the one.
Yeah, I kind of have to get a Saltburn Funko Pop now. Like, I really do. I think that the way that Funko Pop tries to give like the consumerist fandom mindset to every property is yes. so funny. Cause there's some where it just doesn't match up. Like, Saltburn is not a fandom movie where the idea is to buy and advertise that you are a Saltburn fan. Saltburn right. is a fandom movie in that people are writing deranged fan fiction about having sex with these guys on Tumblr.
Like, yeah. My all-time favorite Funko Pop in this genre is the corpse of Laura Palmer Funko
like,
Pop.
Why? Like, yes, here's my collectible corpse.
Oh my God. What a demented culture we live in.
I know.
These are truly the end of times, and I'm glad to be podcasting in them with you.
I've heard from so many different people throughout so many different times in my life that we are experiencing the decadence that preceded the fall of Rome. But you know what? They were kind of making points.
Yeah.
Do you have any more reader mail for me?
Yes, I do. I have one more. This question comes from an Alex J., and he asks, are you ready?
What? 52 Pickup is an Aftermath production created by Gita Jackson and Alex Jaffe and edited by Esper Quim with original music by John Ahrens. The views and opinions expressed on this show are solely those of the show's personalities and do not reflect those of DC Entertainment or Warner Brothers. Please rate and review our show wherever you can and send your questions and comments to 52mailbag@gmail.com. Never stop reading comics.